Welcome to The Landscape, a podcast to shed light on the people, programs, and businesses that are changing the landscape for individuals with any type of disability. I'm your host, Nave Eldar. Today's guest is Netta Ganor, who is a magnificent mouth painter who lives in Israel. Netta is also a mother, wife, IT professional, and children's book author and illustrator. Yep, she's pretty impressive. She's so impressive, when she contacted me after a year from the time that I messaged her, I just couldn't say no to doing the interview. She pulled me out of an 8-month hiatus. Before the interview starts, though, if you are new to The Landscape, please subscribe, recommend to others, and share as widely as you'd like. Now, today's episode starts with my guest telling the story of how she went from what most would consider to be a typical teenager life to becoming disabled and then becoming a mouth painter.
I've always been like a very artistic child, and I love making art crafts. So I was using my fingers and hands a lot. Mm-hmm. And I dealt with so many different kinds of materials. And I like just recycling them and repurposing them and sculpting and knitting and stitching and, you know, just building models. I was a complete normal girl, the way people perceive normal. I was an athlete. I represented my school in competitions, and I was a very good student. I was quite a geek. And then one day I came back from school when I was 15. It was high school, which I just started like 1 month earlier. And then I just ate my lunch. I laid back. I started reading a book and started feeling like very sharp pain in my shoulders, and not in my shoulders, in my shoulder blades.
Okay.
And that pretty quickly turned into numbness. I felt numb all over my body, and I lost the use of my whole body. That means legs, hands, fingers, my breathing muscles. So from being an artist who all the time used her hands for making art crafts and art, but not painting, just 3D.
Okay.
I turned into a complete paralyzed person who cannot do anything for herself, completely dependent on other people. Then I just started rehabilitation and was hospitalized. But you asked me about how I started painting.
Yes.
So that was the turning point. And the turning point was in rehab. I met a girl who painted with both her mouth and her foot, mm-hmm, due to a disability. And I was stunned by how she was painting with her mouth so beautifully. Mm-hmm. She had paintings in her room at rehab. And I thought to myself, hey, maybe I could do that too. I mean, painting was not really my thing, but I was very much into art. And I knew that I would not be able to use my hands anymore. So, but making art was very important. It was like, first of all, it's like therapy for every artist, you would ask. So to get back into this therapy, at least, I knew that this was my only way of trying to, you know, get into, back into shape,
okay,
back into the artistic course. So I asked for, you know, some color or a pen. I don't remember exactly. I asked for a paper, and I tried to put it in my mouth the way I saw her doing it, and started to try and write something or doodle something. It was nothing you can be proud of.
Okay.
It was like a drawing made by a 2-year-old toddler.
Okay.
So I threw it away. I literally threw the pen away from my mouth, and I didn't want to see it anymore. it took a few days for me to recover from this incident. But then it was probably stronger than me, like more powerful than me. I felt like I had to get back and try it and give it another try. So I tried again. And this time I said, okay, I'm not going to give up, because I knew that this is my only chance. So I tried again, and it wasn't easy, but I told myself that I would just need to practice it like any other thing, like practicing sports. Yeah, right. I was an athlete. So I knew that when you practice, you get results. So I started practicing, and within a few months or maybe a few weeks even, I got to the point where my mouth turned into a third hand or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was very capable or able with my mouth. I was really able to paint, to hold my pen, to be very stable with what I do and paint what I want. I had to take lessons a little bit, and I just started painting what I see.
And were you surprised yourself when all of a sudden you started being able to? Like, did you ever think you would get to the point where your mouth would feel like a hand to you?
I was surprised and not surprised, because I have always been like a person who adjusts to any situation. So any new situation would be natural situation for me. Like, I would just adjust to it. And when I adjust to something, I take everything for like, okay, this is how it's supposed to be now. So I was a little surprised, but not too much, because I knew that, you know, if you really put your heart and mind to something, you can achieve what you want to do. So, but I was surprised when I was able to paint something that was pretty nice. I mean, after a few trials and a few lessons from my aunt, who is an artist herself, I was surprised when I was able to reach some kind of a level that I could be proud of. That was a surprise, not the way I reached that level. But
so how old are you at this point? When, like, the first time you painted something that you're like, hey, that's like legit kind of good. How old were you?
It was a little bit after I turned 15 and a half.
Young, really young. I mean, you know, when you, and relatively speaking to myself. And so I was going to ask about teacher. So your aunt was your first teacher, painting teacher. And so what did she work on with you? Like, again, this is like somebody who has no artistic ability, who is absolutely fascinated with the artistic mind, because I don't understand it, right? Like, I look at a sculptor and I don't know how they do what they do. And I see videos of you and pictures of you painting, and I don't understand, like, even like, how do you pick the colors? How do you pick the topic? So what does your aunt work with you on?
First of all, I'll tell you what she didn't work with me on.
Okay.
She didn't work with me on the technique. This is something we both figured out throughout the process, because we had no previous knowledge of that.
Right.
I did have that girl whom I could ask how she does that, and how she's really like holding the brush in her mouth. But it was really a process that we were like trial and error. So, but she did bought materials for me, like colors. She knew that it wouldn't be good to just jump into painting with oils. So we started with acrylics. Acrylics are, are water-based. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty easy to mix them, and you don't really need anything that could be toxic, like turpentine, you know, that you use for oil. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty easy to start using. So she bought the acrylics for me. She bought canvases, and she bought also brushes. And she came with everything one day. She started to give me like a one-on-ones, like on painting, on drawing, on sketching, on painting. And what we started working on was painting still life, because that was very handy. So you could see that vase over there or a chair, and just try to paint what you see. And then she was, you know, correcting me along the way. Do you see that? Do you see, where the shadow is? She gave me a lesson about light and shadow, very basic. Then we just started working. I will not say hands on because it was mouth on, right. But we started to work mouth on. Also, she brought some inspiration material for me. We're talking about the 90s. Yeah. So we didn't really have anything on the internet back then. It was early 90s. So she brought me some magazines and a book about surreal artists that she liked. And I really liked too. And one of the lessons was also to try and copy what I see. Their artwork. So we started painting together. I painted. She saw what I'm doing. She corrected me, said, okay, go with that. This is good. This is not good. You see, this should be more dark. This should be lighter and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how it went.
And how much independence did she give you, or how much did she push you? Let me give an example. Like you said, you had to mix paints. So would you tell her what to mix, or would she be like, no, you need to mix them yourself? Like, how did that work?
So she gave me some freedom. Mm-hmm. And okay, you start, you know, mixing. I did color in the past. I mean, prior to paralysis, I will talk about this. It's like a spinal stroke what I went through. Prior to that, I was used to, you know, mixing colors and painting all sort of things, just not canvases. I mean, I didn't do painting, but I painted stones and other materials. So I kind of knew the basics of how to mix colors, but she stepped in wherever she saw that I need help or wherever she had a good tip for me that could progress me, you know, like don't use yellow, use an ochre. That would give you some more depth to your end color. Mm-hmm. So it's like we were working on this together. She was my private teacher. And but that didn't go... for too long. I mean, after a few lessons, she just gave me complete freedom and I just started painting on my own. Mm-hmm. And I think the greatest exercise she gave me was trying to copy other artists' original works. Mm-hmm. Because when you do that, you get better understanding of how the painting was built layer by layer. Of course, today, videos is the best way to learn because then you really see the actual process and not just the end result of that certain artist. But that's what I did. And later on, I used my imagination and I added a little bit from that. So it kind of made my art more of my own and original. So this is how it all started.
Did you ever end up working with other mouth artists, mouth painters that did work with you, or vice versa? Did you ever work with a younger person who was getting into mouth painting?
Wow. No, I never worked with a younger one. I did get to give tips for someone or two or three quadriplegics who wanted to start with mouth painting. So. Mm-hmm. I did give some advice on what to buy and what to use and how to hold the brush in the mouth. I do meetups with schools, with elderly, with different audiences, and also with disabled people. Uh-huh. So they always ask me, how do you hold the brush in your mouth? Because when we do it like this with our front teeth, but then you are not holding it in a stable way. So you need to hold it with your molars. So that's what I did with younger, like wannabe mouth painters, who turned to be mouth painters in the end. But I never really took serious lessons by professional artists. Yeah, I'm a self-taught artist. Uh-huh. I did take a few lessons with one teacher who is working in Israel with mouth painters. And food painters, but she also sent me my way, you know, she just said, okay, you don't need me anymore. Just do what you do. And you can just watch other artists paint on YouTube. And this is what most of us do. We just watch other artists paint and work. We don't necessarily watch mouth artists. Uh-huh. We just watch artists, like able-bodied artists,
right,
paint by their hands. But I never felt like I really needed more lessons. Maybe it's also due to the fact that this wasn't my main path in life. I did study computer science, mm-hmm, and I did an MBA in information systems, mm-hmm, and I did get a job at a high-tech company, and I had a career. So it's like painting was always my secondary thing, my hobby.
Right.
Until 2003, when I was accepted to the MFPA, mm-hmm, the Mouth and Foot Painting Artists Association.
Uh-huh.
And then it started to get more serious and more professional. But also then, it never felt like work. It felt like I'm doing something that I love doing. I also get paid for it, and it's great. But it's not like someone is sitting next to me, looking at me and say, okay, now you have to paint two paintings in the next 2 hours. No, I do things at my own pace, and I do things the way I want them. It's great and it's fabulous. But I think only recently, in the past like 7 years,
uh-huh,
it turned into a real profession when I started to showcase my art and I started doing interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I also published via the association 2 children's books, which I authored and illustrated. So it started to be a bigger part of my life. And today I can say that it is a very big part of my life. It's more time consuming and it's taking more and more energy, and it's becoming a big part of my life. And I think this is what I'll do until I die. You know, this is something you can keep on doing even after you retire.
Right.
And you never retire from doing art.
Yeah.
So this is really something that's, it's gonna, you know, be part of my life forever until I die. And
nice.
And yeah. I think maybe when I retire, I'll have some time to take lessons.
So how do you choose what your subject is that you're going to paint? And before you tell us that, I want to tell you some of my favorite paintings of yours. That's what's wonderful about art, right? Is that everybody reacts to things differently.
I love it. Yeah.
So I love some of your more intimate moments that you have that are personal. You have one called Childhood Magic, where there's a boy who's on a playground running through like one of those big pipes that they can crouch down and run through. And he's like looking back at, I imagine, his mother or his father, like, you know, with that childhood happiness. And it's just, it's a moment that I just relate to because I've had those moments with my kids and it was just so sweet. And also Serenity by the Lake, where there's a young lady reading, her bike is up against a tree and she's sitting by a lake reading with her back to us, right? And again, it's just such this intimate moment. And then you paint some just absolutely stunning scenes. You have a painting that is called Floral Alley that, in my head at least, it looks like it's in Italy. Like it's like this alley in Italy. It is Italy. Look at me.
It's a town in Italy called Spello.
Look at me. I should get bonus points for that. So how do you choose what to paint?
So I have several sources of inspiration. One of them is nature. We love traveling. We travel to accessible places, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And we do have some of those in Israel. I have also traveled abroad. I've been to Italy.
Uh-huh.
I've been to Barcelona, Spain, and I've been to Eastern Europe. Traveling there, I did get a lot of inspiration from scenery, architecture. Locally, I love Jerusalem.
Yes.
Jerusalem is my hometown. I was born in Jerusalem. I was raised in Jerusalem. And I love Jerusalem's alleys. I love the old city. So you can see a bunch of paintings of old city, like scenes, you know. I love little corners of houses or windows with flowers on them. So this is like nature around me, both rural and urban nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the park near my house, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, this is all nature to me. Usually when we travel and I see something I like and I want to paint, I either take a photo myself, because I have this stand that I put my phone on. I have this stick that I use, and I can click and I can take my own photos. But then sometimes I have to involve someone else and ask them to like stand here and direct them and hold the phone up here. And no, not at this angle, like hold it like that. And okay, now take the photo. So this is one source of inspiration. The other that has become the biggest recently is my family. Since I've started, you know, painting figures and portraiture, I enjoy painting my son and my mm-hmm. newly born son. Uh-huh. I have two sons. One is 8 years old and the other is 7 months old.
Okay.
So I love painting both of them. Obviously, I have more paintings of my eldest.
Right.
I think childhood memories or child, what did I call that painting that you were just talking about?
Childhood magic.
Childhood magic. Yeah. So that's my son over there mm-hmm. when he was 2 years old. He was just having so much fun in the garden or in that, I don't know what to call it, but...
The playground?
Mm-hmm. The playground, yeah. He was having so much fun in the playground. And it was like magic, you know, because when we grow up, we lose that magic sometimes.
Yes.
And that innocence. And he had so much joy, you know, spread over his face. So I had to just take that moment and turn it into art. Intimate moments are, you know, moments that... I aspire sometimes to be in, and because of my disability, I cannot, because I'm dependent on other people, and I cannot really be alone by the lake,
right.
reading a book or just have complete silence and quiet for myself. So these pieces where you see usually a girl or a woman by a lake or at the park or at some quiet place, doing what she does all alone, it's a fantasy for me. Mm. It's a dream. It's something I aspire to be able to do. So that specific girl with the bicycle leaned over a tree, this specific one was a shot taken in Stadtpark in Vienna, Austria. I was there. I couldn't take a photo of that moment, so I asked my caregiver and my husband to take several angles of that young girl. She had no idea we were taking photo of her. Maybe someday this photo will reach her Facebook or Instagram somehow. And if it will ever be viral, and then she will recognize herself. I don't know. But at
That's
that
amazing.
Moment, I thought, I want to be that girl right now. I want to be able to be on my own, read a book, no one else interrupting me. So, yeah. So these are intimate moments that I definitely would love to be able to be in.
So this loops back to when you said that for all artists, there's an element of therapy in it, right? So like painting it is like a therapy for you. That's lovely. I do want to get into something that you touched on earlier, which is you were 15, I believe you said. You came home, you laid down, started having pain in your shoulder blade. So what happened? Like we kind of jumped from there to you being paralyzed. So what, when the hospital looked, the doctors looked, what had happened?
So what happened? It all happened in just out of the blue and in like a flip of a second, almost. Like for me, that was my experience. After I felt my sharp shoulder blade pain, it turned very quickly into just numbness, just like ants are traveling up and down your body. And very quickly, within just 30 minutes, I lost my sensation and I lost the use of my legs and arms and hands. And I was basically paralyzed from my neck down or from my shoulders down. I was lucky to have my mother and my sister home. It was Friday afternoon, and in Israel, this is the beginning of weekend. So my mother called an ambulance, and luckily also we live by a hospital, nearby hospital. They came very quickly. I was still breathing on my own, but I couldn't walk, and I still had function in my left arm. They took me and they ran tests on me. They thought that I was food poisoned somehow because I was throwing up throughout the, let's call it the episode, mm-hmm. but it wasn't that. And through ruling out a lot of diseases, they came to the conclusion that it is a, what you call transverse myelitis. It is a syndrome where the spinal cord is inflated in the central nervous system. And this is just, you know, causing paralysis from that vertebra down. I was transferred into ICU for children. Mm-hmm. I have been there for a month where it took like 10 days to diagnose me. So all those tests and trials and errors and doctor meetings, those all took like 10 days maybe. Mm-hmm. And after ruling out a lot of diseases and a lot of, you know, very serious diseases like multiple sclerosis, ALS, and mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, syndromes and diseases, they came to the conclusion that it is transverse myelitis. I received a lot of steroids that did wonders to the inflammation, but also caused a lot of collateral damage and side effects that were devastating.
Okay.
I mean, I lost hair. I got like a lot of sores all over my body. I was mm-hmm. very sensitive to viruses. So I got sick like every now and then. I also got this very expensive medicine that fought the inflammation. Okay. And stopped it from going further up into my brain. So I was basically at danger for my life. And those medicine saved me. After 1 month in ICU, I was transferred to a rehab center in Jerusalem, but pretty far from my home. So it was very hard for my parents to come and go. You know, I had a young sister. My mother had to take care of her too. So it was running here and there all the time. And basically only after 2 years and 9 months, I was released home, out of which for 9 months we've been building our new home that's been, you know, we built an accessible home.
Okay.
So it took a long time for me to be released from rehabilitation. I had a physical therapy, hydrotherapy, occupational therapy, all the therapies in the world. First 3 months, I got some function back. So my left arm that stopped moving after a few days got back, and my breathing muscles got back. I was able to breathe more independently. I was connected to a ventilator, so I had to wean off that ventilator eventually.
Right.
It took one year and a half to wean off the ventilator through respiratory exercises. Yeah, and a lot of motivation. I needed to, you know, in order to overcome that. But I was able to finally wean off the ventilator because some of my breathing muscles came back. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that is the diaphragm. So until today, I breathe only with 60% of the human's breathing muscles. I only use my diaphragm and my neck muscles, but I don't have these other muscles that every able-bodied person has the use of. So it was a very long process. You know, I was a teenager, so it's like instead of being at school and have a teenager social life, and instead of just having fun and do what other teenagers normally do, I had to spend my time in rehab in a hospital. That is, you know, something that my family had to deal with right. as well, not only myself.
So you went from being this teenager who was on a ventilator, paralyzed from the shoulders down, mm-hmm. not able to breathe for years, right? This went on for, this wasn't like a week or months, for years.
Yes.
It's such a crucial time of your life. And now you're like a professional, which we haven't even gotten into, right? Like we've been talking about your art, but that's not your living. Your living, you are a professional for an international company, which I want to hear about. Yeah. You're married, you have two children. How in the world did you get from that bed to a full normal life? In a level of normalcy that many people don't have. There's many people that aren't married with two kids and a job that pays well. So how did all of that happen and you not just collapse into, I'm just going to live at home with my parents for the rest of my life?
Right. So Rome wasn't built in a day, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't do that all by myself. I had a very supportive family support system, actually, around me. That the main member of that support system was my mother. My mother, she left her job the moment this happened and never got back. She retired very early in life. Mm-hmm. And she just took care of me, took care of everything I need in the hospital and then outside the hospital. We have a very good system in Israel, a very good health system. And we have also live-in caregivers that come from the Far East. So I was able to have a very stable home and stable care. And I was able to focus on my actual life, not on my, you know, care all the time, my health care, my, you know, getting out of bed, getting out of chair, getting a car, replacing my, because my mother took care of all that. And I was under good hands, you know, all the time. So I was able to focus on what I really want to do in life, like any other able-bodied person. So, and I had, and I still have aspirations. I have dreams, and I knew that I had goals that I want to reach, you know? So I don't know. It all came pretty naturally for me, but it doesn't mean that I didn't have struggles and barriers that I have to, you know, to overcome. Mm-hmm. Someone said to me once that it's not enough to have a support system. You also have to have your own strong will and character. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have both, which is a good combination. I don't give up very easily. And I struggle. I fight back. Mm-hmm. So yes, I did have like 2 or 3 months in rehab in which I was depressed. I was down. I needed to be lifted up. I even had a few sessions with a psychologist, but not too many. But I realized that I had two options, you know, to just stay at home, like you said, and not doing anything and just be, oh, my life is terrible. I want to die. I don't want to do anything. Or choose life, mm-hmm. you know, choose the other way. And I had all the tools and support around me in order to accomplish that. I just went on to choosing my college and my subject, my main subject, and studying and focus on what's really important. Mm-hmm. And you know, as a woman, normal, as any able-bodied woman, I wanted to find love. And like most of the women I know, I wanted to become a mother. Not everyone likes to be a mother, and that's totally fine.
Right.
But I really wanted to become a mother. So I pursued that, you know. I signed on to an online dating website. Yes. And I had bizarre dates. I had normal dates. I met so many kinds of guys, and finally I met my first husband, and we got married and we got divorced like any other person,
right?
Any normal person sometimes do. And now I've been married for a year and a half, and we've been together for 5 years already. But this is the real deal.
Yeah.
And yeah, we had a baby 7 months ago via surrogacy. I can get pregnant, but I cannot carry a pregnancy to term. And it's very dangerous for me health-wise. So
right.
That's why I have to do it like via surrogacy.
Yeah. Surrogate mothers. Nice.
Surrogate mother. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. So let me ask you, so most of my listeners, I have listeners that fortunate from all over the world, but the majority of them, like 80% of them are the United States. And so what is, how is the disability community embraced and supported in Israel? Like when you went to college, was it like not a big deal to the professors, or did you have to fight for accommodations? How was that process for
you? Yeah, so students in Israel do not really have, most of them do not have, like, it's not like in the US, distances are not like in the US, you know, this is a very small country. So students just live at home.
Okay.
With their parents, usually. Mm-hmm. Or if it's down, you know, in the south or up in the north, then yes, there are accommodations, but I didn't really need any because my college was in the city I lived in. Mm-hmm. I live in until today. I lived at home. I went to college like for 3 hours, came back home. I had to rest for a while. And then I went back to chair and back to college for a couple more hours. Mm-hmm. That's how my day looked. So it's very different from having college life, you know, like in the US,
right?
Or university life. But living close or very nearby the college really allowed me to do it my way, like to do it very in a flexible way. And college was very flexible with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was 20 years ago, so no, even like more, 25 years ago, I think. It was not very common for a person with disability to go and study in a college. You did see here and there someone in a wheelchair or someone with a minor disability, but someone with a disability like mine, I didn't see any other, you know, quadriplegic sitting in electric wheelchair and driving around the campus. I know that there weren't so many in other universities and colleges back then.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have a very good health system, and we have national insurance that covers a bachelor's degree for, nice. So it covers and funds studies in academy. For a bachelor's degree. So I got my studies funded. I got a computer from the state and all my books and someone to like escort me, you know, like it's not a really caregiver, but just someone
right.
who was next to me all through school. And that is very, you know, that really allows you to focus on school, on studies. It doesn't let you worry about money or how will I fund that. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to think about working in order to fund your school. So
wow,
that's really progressive, I think, relatively to other countries. But there's still a lot of work to do in Israel, you know, as in all around the world, regarding raising awareness to disability and, mm-hmm. and making the system work better. I guess you know that in the U.S. And it is the same in Israel.
Yeah.
But that was the state is very supportive, mm-hmm. and tries to encourage people with disabilities to go out and study and get a job, even more so in the past decade or so.
So, tell us a little bit about your job. What do you do? Who do you work for? How long have you been doing it? All the good stuff about, because I'll tell you, in the United States, and the numbers are probably worse around the world, 70% of individuals with disabilities, if you just take like all disabilities, do not work. So 70% don't work. And so I always love to, anybody who listens to this show knows how much I love employment. So I always love to hear the opposite side of that, because you have a very good job for a very good company. So tell us a little bit about
that. So I work for Applied Materials. It's an American company that has a branch in Israel. I just celebrated 20 years last March.
Nice. Congratulations.
Hawaii. Thank you. I'm not an employee. I'm a subcontractor. I work for another software company that gives services to Applied Materials. But I feel like Applied is my second home.
Okay.
Because I've been there throughout the whole time. I work in Global Information Services Department. So I give services to the United States, to Israel. I mean, this is an internal department. So my clients, my customers are internal. Mm-hmm. My services are, I serve employees from Israel, from the United States, from Asia, and in Europe. So what I do is I specialize in information systems that are collaborative and in knowledge management. So these days I am a knowledge management and collaboration consultant. Previously, I was also a software developer, and I did also UI and UX design. Mm-hmm. And graphic design. I did and I do a lot of stuff. I have different hats that I wear. Yeah. But these days I am a consultant, and I help our organization, our employees and workers to get the most out of what they do by using information systems that help them be more productive, more collaborative, and maintain and share their knowledge. That's basically what I do.
So I listened to all of that, and then basically I just heard that you're like a nerd, basically.
I told you I was a geek as a girl. So,
that is awesome. That is awesome.
I work in IT. You can say, I'm an IT person.
And everybody knows that Israel has some of the best high-tech minds in the world. So the fact
startup that nation.
Startup nations, and you're right in there with them. So that's amazing. So the last thing I want to ask about is your book. You talked about that you have two children's books. So tell us a little bit about
three.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about those, and can they be bought? Can we find them somewhere?
So those books are in Hebrew, unfortunately, yet translated to English. These are children's books that were written in the past decade. The first one was published in 2012. If I translate to English, the title is Who is Wooly? It's about a dog that is coming to this village and all the animals are fighting. And who will be their best friend? Uh-huh. And Yeah, and that is, you know, dealing with the friendship and also embracing those who are different from us, you know, because every animal has their own strengths and, you know, differences from other animals. So I wanted to emphasize that. My second book is about a shrew. It's a very funny animal that has a long nose. And he is a very curious one, and he likes to poke his nose into like anywhere. So it's a very funny one, but also gives a message of be curious. It's good, but be careful also where you go and what you do. but don't stop being curious and search around and investigate and learn about the world. And then my third one was published last year. It's actually a poems book. It's about imagination and fantasy in the children's world. Every poem is about a girl or a boy that has fantasies or has this inner avatar that helps him overcome their barriers and their difficulties in life. And some of these poems were based on my eldest son, Itai. He's also, he has this appearance in my book in 2 out of 14 paintings or illustrations that I did. Yeah, so he appears on the book cover. So he's very famous as a two-year-old toddler. they can be bought online, but yeah, they're only Hebrew.
Okay.
And online on mfpa.co.il/shop.
I will add that link to the description of this episode.
Very cool.
So I just want to thank you. I mean, you're great. You kind of check all the boxes, right? It's like you're artistic, you're brainy, you're a good mom, you're a good advocate, all the things that
trying to do. My
yeah,
best.
It's amazing.
I don't know if I'm the best mom, if I'm the best advocate, if I'm the best, you know, in what I do, but I do try to be the best I can. And I think what you do is very important. I mean, I'm going to be now an avid listener to your podcast. And please don't stop it.
Oh, thank
please
you.
Please continue what you do.
I will try. I will do my best.
I know.
As the listeners know, it's been like 10 months. So they're going to be, when this comes out, they're going to be like, oh my gosh, there's a new episode all of a sudden. So even you're right. Even if I can only do it every so many months, I love because there's nothing that brings me joy like speaking to people like
really?
You. So, it teaches me so much that helps me in my life in every aspect, like as a dad, as a worker, as a you know all of the things that I do. So anyway, so thank you again, Dash to Israel for me because I haven't been there. And since, well, COVID, my wife was there last year. She turned 50. Oh. And so she's born and raised in Israel. So she was like, I'm going. And there was this perfect window of being allowed out into the world because of COVID. And yes. So there were concerts going on when she was there. All the restaurants were open. And then right after she came home, they closed again. So it was almost like it was perfect for her birthday.
True.
But anyway, so tell...
And this is not really related to the podcast, but your name is Eldar, right?
Nave Eldar.
Nave.
Yeah.
And this is an Israeli name, but
yes.
your wife is Israeli, but you are also?
I am. Okay. I live there. Garti sham shesh v'chetzi shanim.
Ah,
here shnei yeladim that live
wow.
there. Be'afula. Both of my children were born in Afula.
But before that, you were not born
Ohio,
in
Ohio. Ohio. I'm from Ohio,
wow.
in the United States. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So my wife will be very happy to hear me speak a little Hebrew on the podcast.
Find links to Netta's Instagram page and personal website in the description of the episode. You can also find links to ordering her books on her personal website. I don't know what to say now. I'm not sure when I'll be back, but I will do my best to release an episode in less than 8 months this time around.
Either way, I hope everyone is doing great, and I'll see you next time.